If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Paul, it's a real pleasure to have you come join me in the psychotherapist chair today. Spend a few minutes just telling us about your life journey in sort of thumbnail sketches. Give us an overview of the arc of your life. What's it been like?
It's been fantastic, actually. Born in 63, so right at the end of the baby boomer, one of the last, in Eastbourne, Wellington, eastern side of the harbour. It was like a golden childhood. The sea, the hills, the bush, the safety, the community. It was just a fantastic place to grow up, and so much so that I brought my own kids up there. And if there was somewhere better, I would have gone there. But it was a lovely upbringing. It was sort of kind of a bohemian community because it was sort of isolated from Wellington. You had to, you know, do a 40-minute bus trip to get there. A certain type, I guess, lived out there. Its early history is one of a sort of a go-to place. Days Bay always was a sort of like a summer escape place for Wellingtonians. They'd get on the ferry, the Cobar or the Muratai, go over there in the early days. In fact, my grandmother grew up there for a few years. She was at the school that I went to as a primary school student, but she was there in 1914. So that was a stretch back. And there's a family photo of her and her two sisters sitting by the Days Bay Wharf. And in the background, you can see a few kids jumping off the wharf. I have that exact picture with my three kids and people jumping off the wharf. So there's been a sort of like a continuum of family involvement and existence in that community. So it'll always be home. So it was a great upbringing, a local school, local community that looked after itself. One thing that I do remember, and moving into, you know, a huge leap to where I am now, I do remember the Anzac Day parades. We used to go there as kids. And back then, so we're talking early 70s there, late 60s, early 70s, a lot of the veterans were still alive. First World War veterans, Second World War certainly, but First World War, quite a few of them. And they were local identities as well, you know, families that had been there. And if you read the scroll of honor on the school gates at my old school, you'll recognize the family names. They're there. That suburb lost 114 men, and it was only 1,800, 2,000 population. So that's the impact it had. And I kind of always used to think about, you know, those old guys. And of course, they die out slowly. And now the Second World War ones are gone too. And the reason I connect it with today is that's why I think we've got so much on the line. Because these people, men mainly, but the women coped as well. That they put, and okay, you can argue First World War, should we have been there? Were we cannon fodder for the British? All that. But I think the Second World War is next level. You know, in their minds, they were doing something for their country and they were protecting it and they were willing to lay down their lives, actually, whether they'd been brainwashed into it or whatever. And I think that the respect, that's huge respect there, and it's gone. It's gone. And that's a tragedy. For me, you know, you forget your history, man, and it's not good. So I remember those Anzac parades as a kid there, and that had a big effect on me. It really did. And when I get angry about what's happened today, I think of those men lined up. You know, a lot of them went off. A lot of them didn't come back, you know. So without getting too down on that, that's one thing I remember. But the other thing was the harbour. I used to watch all the shipping come in and out, like the ferries, the Aramoana, the Aranui, the Aratika, the Arahanga, and the Wahine. I remember the first thing I can remember, Jerry, like a conscious, strong memory that I know that I remembered and saw, is the Wahine sinking at the heads of Wellington Harbour when the mist cleared. Yeah, I did. When the mist cleared, I could see the orange funnel lying on its side at the heads of the harbour. And obviously the storm was huge and scary. And I remember the winds and we're right on the waterfront and the rocks being sprayed up on the windows from huge waves, you know, 10, 15 foot waves, unprecedented. And later on, I used to, the kids were growing up, I used to go running down the Piankaro coast to the lighthouse there. And you'd sort of intersect the point, Steeple Rock at the other side of the harbor entrance where the Wahine went down. And I always thought of them. I always remembered that. So that was a powerful thing. And, but I used to watch all the shipping and the first thing I wanted to be was the captain of a ship because it looked so cool, right? Then, Jerry, I saw an NAC 737 fly overhead for the first time, roaring jet engines. And that would have been in the first probably few weeks of us having jet aircraft transport for domestic operations. Now, as we get through the story of me, you'll see the relevance of that come into it. So then I wanted to be an airline pilot. But then one day, I got a transistor radio for Christmas, Sony transistor radio, probably 7 or 8 years old. And they were new, I think, the little ones then. And I turned it on and I tuned it around and I hit on 2ZM, which was the music station in Wellington. And then I didn't want to be an airline pilot anymore. I wanted to be a music DJ on the frickin' radio, man, because that sounded cool. So that's when I knew what I wanted to do, probably about age 10 or 11, and still had a little squeaky little voice. And I got interested in audio stuff then, equipment, turntables, all that sort of stuff, and accumulated a collection along with an old friend of mine who was an electronics expert, because back in the day, those systems are very expensive, and a lot of people used to build them themselves. We built our own speaker boxes and we built our own amps and did all that and sort of simulated radio stations. And I would have a little speaker and I'd say to my sisters, "Hey, do you want to listen to me and I'll play some songs?" And I still get ribbed about that. And sort of literally practiced. And after a while, I think my father was getting a little concerned that I was not looking at a stable career path at this point because he didn't think that was like a real job. And initially tried to remind me that, you know, he was a printer at the time. He ended up being a psychologist, funnily enough. He thought a trade was a sensible thing to get. And it was, you know, something metal work, maybe fitter and turner. There was the railways workshop in Moera, which is a suburb not too far away. And there was the GM plant and there was a Ford assembly plant. There were sort of industries like that. And a lot of people, it was, absorbed a lot of employment. And he wanted me to consider that. But now I want to get on the radio. So, one day I went to, in Days Bay, the 2ZM radio station had one of their summer beach discos. I thought, oh, this is good. Because I always wondered what these guys looked like. You know, you hear the voices, but what do they look like? And I'm sure people have built up a picture. They listen to you and they think, anyway, I bet he looks like this. Or they get a kind of a vision, you know, of what you might look like. And same with me. Usually they're disappointed. and I went to this thing and they were playing. You know, I had this huge sound system set up. There's all these people, you know, and it was a lovely sunny early evening. And they were playing. They played a song by Pablo Cruz. They were a California rock band in the 70s, and they had a few hits. So they got a very distinctive sound, and I guess their genre comes under yacht rock now, you would say. So I find it hard to pin that one down, but yacht rock. And they do a song, and it's not on my song list, but they did a song called A Place in the Sun, and they were playing A Place in the Sun. And I thought, this confirms that I have to do this. All those guys at that thing, all their personalities from the radio station were all my colleagues within 2 years.
Wow. Wow.
That's right.
That's amazing. How old were you then? How old 16. When they were your colleagues?
I was 16. I was the youngest announcer ever hired by Radio New Zealand. Now, how did that come about? Well, my mother, at the end of my second year in the fifth form, said, "Paul, what are you going to do? You know, you're not very well qualified." I mean, I could have gone into a trade school, C and all that in the end. "What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, I know what I want to do. I want to be, you know, I want to get on, be a radio broadcaster." Updated the description now. And she said, "Well, what if that doesn't happen? You have to have some others." So I said, "Okay, or a journalist or a sound engineer," I think I said. But that would have ended up at like the film unit or RN Radio New Zealand anyway, because there weren't too many operations, you know, training people up for that. So she said, "I'll write you a forwarding letter to help you, and you can send it to the Evening Post newspaper." I think it was to the film unit and to Radio New Zealand. So, and I had a tape, you know, I made a tape, an audition tape, and father's got a great singing voice, and I don't know if I had a very good voice at all, but I trained my voice. I did. I trained my voice. And I did it enough to get the attention of the chief announcer at Radio New Zealand, a guy called, at the time, Brian Scott. Yeah. And he was the guy who all the auditions went to, and he would go, yes, no, you know, like that. And I got a letter back, said, come on in. We're interested in talking to you. My mother couldn't believe it. I actually didn't hear back from the other two. So I went in and they put a microphone around my neck, this sort of weird thing where it hung a microphone, and gave me a thing to read. So I did that. And I wasn't even very good at reading, you know. See, you learn these things as you go. So I stumbled around a bit. But anyway, they liked the sound of the voice. And they asked me a few questions about what I thought of radio and what sort of programs there should be and stuff. And then I didn't hear anything for ages. About a month later, I get another letter back saying, we want to bring you into the cadet scheme. Okay? Which, thank God, because it meant I learned everything. I've got put through everything. My first job was literally emptying the rubbish bins in the office of the Tonight Show. And that was a show done by Wayne Mowat, who's the broadcaster's broadcaster in New Zealand. Wayne's fantastic. He's still around, but he's obviously long retired. And I'm in there thinking, oh, my God, it's Wayne Mowat. It's Wayne Mowat. I'm in here with Wayne Mowat. And sort of then got into doing the scheduling of the music. We had a primitive computer program that did that back in the day. And sort of getting in, starting to ring people up to see if they could come on Wayne's show and things like that. So, you know, you sort of get into the system. And then music research was a big thing there too, because radio got very competitive as the independent commercial radio stations came up. It was a real dogfight for advertising money, even back then. So on the music stations that Radio New Zealand owned at the time, they had consultants come in from the United States, very competitive markets. And there's all these systems for researching the songs that people liked. And but anyway, I got down in that as well. And then after a while, the big opportunity came, and 2ZM down the road, their night announcer had, I think he was in a car crash or something. I can't remember, it's so long ago. Or he had some medical turn and they needed someone quick. And they said, if we show you the ropes today, can you come down and do the night program, give you a go on that tomorrow? I thought, I can't believe this. This is it. And that happened the next day, and I didn't screw it up. Kept it real simple. At the age of 16, remember, and then for about the next, I don't know, 6 months, I was the night sky. And it's funny because all my friends from school, of course, are listening. They can't believe it. How the hell did that happen? So that's how I sort of fired from being a kid into the broadcasting system, and obviously I've been in that, in and out of that, and all sorts of different ways all this time leading up to now. And I have to say, Jerry, it's been good to me. It has. It's been good to me. I chose the right thing. I did.
Amazing. An amazing story, really, of in some way just following your heart, following your interest.
Yeah, I think so.
And having some support for that. I mean, I know your dad sounded a bit like he was a bit down on you for not doing a straight job or anything, but I mean, how lovely to have your mum sort of write the letter and give you that support.
I got the impression, though, she thought this is about the only thing I can do. Anything after this is unpredictable, you know. But I think that they, well, I haven't talked to them about that for a long time, but, you know, I think that they were happy the way it had turned out. I mean, it was a good solid career for 10 years in the RNZ system, for sure.
So your career's been in radio, but you said something about aeroplanes, I think.
Yep, I've always had that from that moment I saw that jet fly over. I've always had an interest in flying, anything that flies. I like even watching birds, you know, fly around. And there's some amazing videos now of high-def cameras attached to, like, eagles and condors. And you look along the leading edge of their wing, it's incredible. It's incredible what nature can do. Every feather positions itself in real time relative to the other one. And there are about 1,500 feathers on one just one side of the wing of an eagle. So if we can ever get to that, we'll have efficient flying machines. So anything that flies, wings, aerodynamics, I don't know why. I just really love them. And the other thing is too, and we'll go through this, but I've met a lot of famous people, legendary people in aviation over the years, like really famous, like Neil Armstrong and Gene Cernan and Scott, what's his name, who flew the X-15, and General Paul Tibbets, who dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. I met him, had a chat with him. Incredible people. But what that engineering represents is the finest of human achievement. It really is. It really is. You know? And there's something about that that really interests me, to the point where I want to bring it all back from my childhood, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do, retrieving old planes. It's taken 7 years to get to almost getting one, but we don't do these things for a sugar high, you know?
Tell the listeners what it is you're doing with these planes.
Well, okay, with the planes, of course, New Zealand, being an isolated country, has connected with the world through aviation substantially, though there was a huge shipping operation going out here. We'd had family friends come out from the UK because my father was from the UK, and they would arrive on the Southern Cross or the Northern Star at the overseas terminal in Wellington, big ships on regular scheduled runs before airliners. So I remember those days, and that was exciting. That really was, especially seeing it off, you know. But aviation took over and global transportation, and we had to get with it or we'd be completely isolated. And again, it goes to respect of earlier generations, like I was saying about the old soldiers, is that for a long time there, when you're youth, you're a bit arrogant. I used to see those, a lot of, you know, the older New Zealanders as really straight. You're so straight and boring. As I've gone into this exercise, I realized that was just a superficial thing. Again, guys that you would think look straight and boring, they gave you the standard of living. Don't ever forget it, because they did ballsy things. They did, as an example, the 737, that was bought at a time when the UK, we were still on the apron strings of the UK, and we were expected to buy British no matter what. It was a huge deal to say, nah, your product's not good enough. We're taking the American product. There was a huge debate back in the time. And if people had got that wrong, their careers would have been destroyed. You know, ballsy stuff. I met a guy called Alan Kenning. Alan Kenning, who's dead now, long dead, from Paraparaumu, north of Auckland. Wellington, what am I saying? I was in Auckland. I'm in Wellington now. And he was the flight operations chief of National Airways Corporation, which preceded the domestic component of Air New Zealand. Air New Zealand absorbed NAC into its operation, and that's where the domestic service of Air New Zealand originated from, NAC. And I've seen the telex that he sent when he went over to Seattle, and he himself flew with Brian Weigel, who's one of the most famous test pilots in the world. He was the co-pilot of the 747 on the first test flight. Brian Weigel, they ended up being personal friends. Brian Weigel's still alive. He's in his late 90s now. And flew the first 737 ever made, okay? And I've seen the telex of him reporting back to Doug Patterson, the head of NAC. And in that telex, that's how we traveled for the next 45 years. Right there, you know? You'd never know the guy. Mild-mannered, so polite, so humble, but a genius. And after he retired, Boeing hired him as a consultant. So all the 737s, that, and there are over 10,000 in the world, their control, feel, and settings and all that, they came, a lot of that came through Alan, you know? And pilots will tell you, great flying airplane. Yeah, thanks, Alan. You know? So I respect those people. And you only find out later that what you thought was sort of boring and, you know, handbrake, stick in the mud, are actually incredible people. And so that motivates me to find these planes. There are only six of them left, the original ones, all the others, because we had fleets, right, multiples, but they've all been destroyed because they're all really old. And so I've found out that there's a copy of each of them left in the world, only one, all scattered around. So I've made it, me and a few others. If we can do it, and maybe we can't, that it's a damn good thing to try and prevent them from being destroyed. So at least someone later on, whenever, can do something with them, because that's how we built the nation, right? So the aircraft are, the oldest aircraft is the Lockheed Electra, four-engine turboprop aircraft. And now this, we had five of them that were ordered by Teal, Tasman Empire Airways Limited, which was pre-Air New Zealand. And we had, I think the Aussies are in there, that's the A. The Empire is the British, and Tasman is us, you know, Tasman C, Limited. It was a four major shareholders. Well, New Zealand obviously took over its airline and became sole owner of its airline, changed the name to Air New Zealand. But the Electras came when Teal was still painted on the tail, and that was right after the flying boats. Flying boats, you know, that changed everything. Now you could get to Australia in 2 hours instead of eight. Oh, no, sorry, 4.5 hours instead of eight, you know, in the flying boat. Sometimes they used to have to throw stuff overboard on those flying boats to stay in the, you know, if they're running low on fuel and stuff like that. And there's some horrendous stories over the time, but no one was killed. My grandmother did the flying boat flight in 1938 out of Wellington Evans Bay to Rose Bay, Sydney. 38. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and it took 9 hours, I think, and flying along at 4,000 feet. Imagine that over the entire Tasman Sea. Anyway, so it was a huge progression. So the Electra, that exists still, and the oldest one that was delivered in 59 is still flying in Canada. It was converted to a firebomber to fight forest fires at great expense as well. And it's got about 2 years to run before they can't fly it anymore, because it'll be, we'll do the math, 59, 640, it's, yeah, 65, coming up 70 years old, and Lockheed won't support any of the metal properties in any of the components after that age. So it can, you could do it up as much as you like, never fly it again, pretty well. So that's sitting in Canada at the moment. And as soon as it's done, they'll let us know. The 737 that I mentioned flying overhead when I was a kid could have been the one that's sitting in a field in North Carolina, in USA. And that was the first jet aircraft to do the first domestic commercial jet service in the country on the 8th of October, 1968. I met the guy who flew that out, the delivery flight, Warren Schrader, Smokey Schrader. They call him Smokey because he was a World War II fighter ace. You know, those guys were still around, right? And Smokey Schrader flew it in. I got to meet Warren Schrader. I've got an interview. I interviewed all these guys back in the 90s because I got so crazy about all this. I thought I got to interview all this because they're all, geez, in their 80s, getting into their 80s then. So I've got probably 10 interviews with all the main players back then, and they're all long gone, and it's like valuable, valuable stuff because they tell the story. Anyway, that aircraft is sitting in a field in North Carolina. That's there for us. The one in Brazil, in Manaus, Brazil, I've been to that. is the last, as you might remember, the DC-8 airliner, four engine. It was a competitor to the Boeing 707. So 59 it flew. The only, as far as we know anyway, commercial airliner to break the sound barrier. So that's its claim to fame. We had eight of them. This is the last one. And it's interesting, this one, sitting at the airport derelict at Manaus, Brazil, in the Amazon jungle, right? It flew for a cargo airline out of Manaus in the last years of its life, last flew in 2003. The owner of it, who we've since found and become friends with, was a Florida guy who used to lease out freighters to South American airline companies. That's a hard business. So you have to know what you're doing there. It took off from Manaus on a hot night. Everything's a hot night there. They number three engine caught fire right as they're rotating into the air. The thing was fully loaded. I think they were flying somewhere way down south in South America, maybe into Argentina somewhere. So they're fully loaded with fuel. And obviously when you've got a fire like that, you can't extinguish. You've got to get back down on the ground as soon as possible. So they flew it around in the pattern, came and landed, broke the left gear because it was so overweight, but didn't crash it. Thing got dragged off the side of the runway and literally sat there since 2003. Well, we come along in 2019. Hello, we're from New Zealand. And there she is sitting there. And, you know, I did a bit of research into that aircraft. That aircraft carried the Queen into Christchurch for the Commonwealth Games in 1974. I've got pictures now of her and Princess Anne and a few other of the royals coming down the steps of NZC, which was its registration. And when I was in the cabin of it, because it was converted into an old truck of the sky, you know, a freighter, I was trying to imagine them sitting up there where this pair of vultures had made their nest right up at the end of the cabin. It had been touched by royalty, but you wouldn't know. Anyway, so there's that aircraft. We've got that. We own it now. So we just got to get it back here. There's a 747. We had eight of them, I think, that we owned in Roswell, New Mexico. That's hard because they're big. There's a DC-10 in Havana, Cuba, the last one. DC-10's got a big part of our history because it was a DC-10, the sister ship, actually, of this one that exists in Cuba that flew into Mount Erebus. And that was, okay, I told you about the Wahine disaster. The other thing I remember is the Erebus disaster. That was a shocker. That stopped a nation. I can remember what I was doing when I heard about that. It's one of those things. So that aircraft is in Cuba, and I've been maintaining relations with the Cuban foreign affairs folks over there. So the idea is to try and at least save them from being destroyed. So have some sort of ownership, local storage if it's needed, and we've got that's easy to arrange, you know. But one day get them back here. I got one of my trustees is Jason Rhodes at the National Transport and Toy Museum in Wanaka. Perfect place to put them. We've already got some aircraft and we've got some jet engines that will go with the 737 coming in. And people say, well, why are you doing that? Well, I've said, you know, I love the it's all about the people. But actually, it's very selfish, Jerry, very selfish. Those are seared memories for me. And I kind of want the real thing back. Photos aren't enough.
Something very, very concrete about what you're doing. It's like you're gathering in our history and you're bringing it back home, right?
That's the aim. I've got all these little catchphrases. History isn't real, really, until it's physical, is what I think. And I've been to a lot of the incredible aviation museums around the world. All I want to see, because I see myself there, all I want to see is those little kids standing under these huge machines and looking up in awe and going, geez, I wouldn't mind being part of that. That's what I want. I want people to be in, particularly kids, to be inspired, you know, and to go, wow, like I used to do. So it's kind of selfish in a way.
Yeah, I do think that you're talking about something very precious here, though. Your descriptions of the old fellas from the First World War on the harbor, at the harbor. I think you were talking about them at the harbor, weren't you?
Yeah. Just those people I remember, but particularly those guys, because I think of them now when I feel like we've been so under attack. And I'm thinking, don't you freaking know how freedom is won, you morons? People laid down their lives. You know, mothers had two or three sons taken from them in these situations. And well, not only that, PTSD ruined a lot of relationships. It was very difficult to keep it together, you know? And what, is that not worthy of thought? Where do you think you came from, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that strikes me over and over again is there was a particular age group where, you know, there were grandfathers or sometimes great-grandfathers who were heavily traumatized in the First World War. They came back and their sons were then traumatized in the Second World War. And then their sons were now growing up with pretty much emotionally absent grandfathers.
Yeah.
And emotionally traumatized and absent fathers. And guess what they did? They turned to alcohol.
Yeah. 6 o'clock swill closing. It was horrible.
And how do you deal with a pain that you can't see? It's one thing to fight and to have something to shoot at, but when you can't see what you're trying to deal with, and you don't even know what it is. I think of the children growing up with the parent who's an alcoholic, whose grandfather was in the Second World War, whose great-grandfather was in the First World War. There'll be listeners listening now who will absolutely relate to what I'm saying here. And it's like, now it's almost like we haven't moved away from physical war. It's still going on around the world, and it should stop immediately, but in my opinion. But
I agree.
We've got another war going on, which is an invisible war, which started with those physical wars. And people are growing up in environments where they do not have the security, the safety. You described a beautiful childhood, a golden childhood, in fact. And I reckon there'll be many people who, Wellingtonians, who will be really reassured and remember many of the Wellington names and places that you did, that will be remembering those times as well. Listeners who will relate to what you're talking about. But there's this, what fascinates me is how do we New Zealanders, and even though I don't sound very Kiwi, I was born here, how do we come to terms with the invisibility of a pain that we don't even know the source of, a something missing, a father being there, a grandfather taking you out to the shops, these really simple human needs that got cut by violence and war, so that I'm just struck by that, Paul, and your love of history and your love of New Zealand, really just, you exude it, man. You totally exude it.
Well, it would probably be the same wherever you are. And I've spoken to other people through the course of the Plains exercise in other countries who are trying to do the same thing for the same reasons. You know, it's kind of the same reasons. But to talk to your point there, we need to know. This is the thing. You need to know about what's happened. You need to understand. This is what I keep coming back to, and this is what frustrates me a lot about today's people, in a way, is that they don't know how we ended up here, how we got here. Now, I was having a really interesting chat with an auntie of mine over Christmas. We hadn't seen each other for ages. And of course, she's the daughter of my grandfather, who died when I was 7. So I really didn't get to know him. One of the early emotional experiences I remember is suddenly realizing I wouldn't see my granddad again. Oh, is that what that means? Dying, you know? And that was really sad. I do remember that striking me. But anyway, we were talking about, you know, his parenting and stuff like that, you know, and just general family chat. And I said, well, you know, why was he a bit like that? You know, he used to favor some, not the others. He used to get pissed off about certain things. And she said, PTSD, dear. He was in New Guinea during the Second World War, and he was in the Australian Army, not the New Zealand Army, and he was an engineer. So that was actually even more dangerous because they were sent ahead of the lines to survey out possible airstrips, places to land, where you could invade a hill versus the other side of it, those things. And I've seen some of his letters to my grandmother at the time. A lot of it's very euphemistically described because you had to be careful what you said in those letters and they would be censored. The fear, every day, the fear, man, and not just of the Japanese, but of crocodiles, snakes, even some hostile, you know, mud men. I think you get there. So, yeah, of course. And then you come back to New Zealand and, you know, certain people you see still got their good jobs and they haven't gone anywhere. And there's a lot of resentment about that too back in the day. So, of course. So, you know, a lot of questions, you know, are answered. Things fall into place when you understand that. Of course, it must have been, you know, freaky.
What you're talking about, Paul, is so important because, you know, you talk about history, but history isn't just a bunch of facts in a textbook, and history's not something that some tedious teacher is making you study because you'd rather be out playing in the sun. You know, history is tangible, right? History is that's what you do with these aeroplanes, because these aeroplanes are carrying memories of real people doing real ballsy things, right?
I'm so glad you brought that up. Sorry to jump in, but I got something to say about that. One of the people I've befriended over the years in this exercise, and he's in his early 90s now, is a guy called Bob Bogash, and he lives in Seattle, Washington. And he was the quality assurance manager for Boeing commercial aircraft for 25 years. Okay? Quality assurance. Now, they're having problems now with their quality assurance. So he was an absolute veteran of the airline industry. After he retired, he set about reclaiming artifacts for the Museum of Flight, which is at Boeing Field in Seattle, which has the first 74, the first 73, which Alan flew, all right? I actually went and filmed that plane in 2003. I got a job because I was a film cameraman and a video guy for a long time as well. We could talk about all the things I've done, but that was one of the things. Got a job with the Centennial of Flight Commission in the U.S., to go and film all around America stories on video in time for the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' first flight. So one of them was I got talking with Bob. Someone put me onto him, and I wanted to do a piece on the first jumbo, the first 737, the first 727, the first 707. I couldn't actually film that because that was in the desert in Arizona at the time, and I went to Seattle to do this. We went over to a place called Moses Lake, which is across the eastern side of the Cascade Mountain Range. So on a good day, you can see Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier, you know, sticking up. And of course, St. Helens was the one that blew its side out of. But this area, Moses Lake, is really interesting geological feature because it was this huge lake, the size of Lake Taupo. But through some seismic event, the side of it fell away. So all the water in the lake, you can imagine the volume of water, poured out. And you can see these massive undulations in the landscape where the water's, you know how you see on the beach, you see sand in a certain pattern from the water going over. Well, this is like 500 feet high patterns, and you can just see what happened. Anyway, so it's a stunning place, and that's where they had that stored. And Bob, who was in his job, well, he retired now, he wasn't flying then, but he was certified to fly all those airliners, you know, as a captain, because it basically a test pilot as well as being quality assurance manager in the job. They all flew. All the engineers flew back in the day. Anyway, he would go out every month and pull the tumbleweed. It's classic, you know, Western stuff, tumbleweed out of all the undercarriage and bits and start it up and taxi it around to keep it operational, because eventually they're going to fly it over the mountains into Seattle and put it in the museum. So I had to be able to fly. So he kept it going. So anyway, we went over there with him one day, this most amusing 6-hour drive in his Jeep over through the Cascade Mountains to Moses Lake. And this aircraft, the first one ever built, was used to pioneer all the video screen technology that's now in airliners. You know, the old gauges have gone, now it's all screens. And it had a cockpit, an actual cockpit of an aircraft inside the cabin. And they would test all the instrumentation and controls, fly-by-wire controls from there. While the guys in the real cockpit sat there and were just there in case anything went wrong. Quite a unique aircraft. And that was the one that Alan flew. And I got up those steps and I said, Alan, this is for you, mate. So that was cool.
Wonderful.
Anyway, where was I on all of that? I sort of went off on a bit of a tangent.
Your love for planes and your love of everything, Paul. I think that's something.
I love everything, Jerry.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear, man. And the listeners get that from you. And I think that's why so many people love your show. They want to connect with a real person who values things that are important and that have our past. I mean, it wasn't so many weeks ago, you know, I was in Wanaka. I'm from Wanaka. So the toy museum and your connection with that is known to me. But I was in a talk called Truth and Lies where Susie Wiles was literally on the stage saying, well, I don't think freedom of speech should be available to everyone. And it was, really? It was like, really. And people just sat there and thought this was okay. And I wanted to strangle everyone in the hall, actually, who was nodding their heads and laughing
This really interests me because obviously you had a lot to think about lately. And you mentioned the love of all that comes from love. Ultimately, I think I've thought about this a hell of a lot. Where do the good things come from? Where do they come from? How they generate? What generates it? What makes it good versus the other? And I think it's fundamentally love. And I think love, if you want to explain it, is like a highly organized. So highly organized information. It's not chaotic. It's not, what's the third law of thermodynamics? You know, it's not everything disorganized or random, you know? I'll come up with a word in a moment. I think about it a lot, but I always forget it. You know, the steam engines used to be afflicted with it. What love does is it orders things. It creates meaning is created around things. And the more meaning it has, I think the more organized the information is. So it's no wonder that good things come out of it. It's like when you tidy your room, Jerry, it feels better, right? Chaos is not nice. You clean your car, it seems to run better. It sort of feels like it. You know, there's something in not ordering things clinically, but making doing the best with the information. Everything's information in the end. And I think, you know, that's where the love comes from. The reason I mention that is I think that's been sucked out of the room. It's been sucked back to a fear state, which is chaotic, disorganized, you know? And nothing good can come from it. And you know what? I look around and I know I'm right. Nothing good comes from it. And that's what we're seeing. And that's the battle we're fighting. Now, what you want to call that, I don't know. Some would say it's a spiritual war. Some would say it's, you know, moral war. I don't know. It doesn't matter how you define it. It's at that level, I think. And I don't know. I hope it can come back. But, you know, when I when you describe what happened in that get together, and I see comments to things all around and stuff, I wonder where people's heads are at. How could you be thinking that? How could you have that attitude? What's happened in your life to twist you up so much, you know? I don't have any of those answers. You'd know more about that than me. But I think we've lost the love and hearts have hardened. And I didn't expect this. I didn't see this coming. Did you?
No way. No, I mean, I think what you've described is really interesting, though, because you're talking about the absence of love.
Yeah. Or the subtraction of it. Yeah.
But you're not talking about just its absence. You're talking about the injection of fear.
Yeah.
To both destroy the love and to fill the space that love would probably have filled. And
entropy. Entropy was the word I was trying to think of. Entropy. So fear state is a state of high entropy. Love state is a state of low entropy. And a lot more happens low entropy than high entropy. Put it that way.
And I'm just trying to think what that word entropy really means.
Well, I can tell you because tell you.
Tell us what it means.
It's the third law of thermodynamics states that the entropy of a closed system at thermodynamic equilibrium approaches a constant value when its temperature approaches absolute zero, and that entropy is always one way to higher entropy. So any system will become more disorganized and chaotic as it goes on in time. That's why the steam engines had problems. When they started building steam engines, for the first year, they'd run really well. But now they're not so much power in them anymore. What's going on? Well, it's the machine encounters entropy. Things start to wear down. Things don't work as well as they did at the start. And the system degrades. The ultimate entropy state is the black hole. Because everything is pulled in. And even at a quantum level, everything is pulled apart. Nothing has a history anymore. That's total chaos. There's no meaning. It's all gone. It's erased. And I think, you know, ultimate fear is that state. Ultimate love is, you know, it's singing angels, it's orchestras, it's beautifully organized information.
Wow. That is so beautiful, Paul. Thank you for sharing that. That is really,
I think you have to understand what love is, you know, and it takes a bit of a lifetime. And I could be wrong, but, you know, there's lovey-dovey, you know. But what is, and I remember, I've encountered it a few times, and I know that people who have near-death experiences talk about this profound love. Well, I've never been that near death, though I've been facing down a few issues that could have led to that, and that sharpens you up. But, you know, you have moments in your life where you have these sort of overwhelming feelings. And it's only happened a couple of times to me. Once, soon after my grandmother died, I got overcome with this beautiful joy emotion. I had to pull over on the side of the road because my eyes teared up. I didn't know where it came from. It could have been a legacy of that. Who knows? Anyway, it was a wonderful thing. And afterwards, I thought, well, the feeling was you don't need to be afraid of anything, actually, is what that told me. And then I remember a few times, skip all the way through to those parliamentary protests, and I wasn't there, but I was watching everything on the feeds. And there were certain moments there where I felt the same feeling again. And I thought, that's love.
Well,
and it is.
Yeah.
And I wish other people could see that. The people are so hard. You just missed it.
You're talking about hardening the heart, aren't you?
Yeah, and I wonder what's causing it. Things have never been easier in history, Jerry. We don't have to fight the saber-toothed tiger. We don't have to, you know, expend huge amounts of energy and time and danger to live an everyday life. That's all gone. It's luxurious compared to that. What's the frickin' problem? This is what
That is a very big question, isn't it? A very relevant one. You know, I wondered about what you said about love, and you said about fear, and you talked about that movement from love to fear.
Yeah.
That entropy. That if we don't feed and understand and work at love, I think that's where entropy sets in, surely.
Yeah, because you see, to offset entropy, work is required, just like the steam engine. You've got to pull it apart, clean all the components, replace the ones that don't work properly, put it back together, and she's ticking over like the day it came off the production line. It can be, you can push back against it. You've got to do work. Yeah.
I think there's something in this, and I'm looking all the time for these remarkable times we're living through right now. The very reason for RCR existing is to find a way through, to talk sense, to find what is true, what is reality. That's why I went to the Truth and Lies. I thought, well, maybe they've got some access to truth that I've been missing. You know, maybe I've been missing something. And I went in with a genuinely open mind. to this talk on truth and lies, probably the most important subject we've got going right now. In fact, in another piece, I suggested that maybe RCR should change its name to Truth and Lies, because there's nothing more important right now. And that's what we're trying to get at, isn't it? All the time on your show, on other people's shows, we're trying to get to this idea of, hey, man, what's real? What can we trust? What is truthful?
Yeah.
Who's spinning a lie to us? Who's got an angle? And what you're talking about is almost at a level even below that. You're talking about a level of how do we work at love? Because if we don't work it, we're in trouble, right?
I think so, because the ultimate destination is the other way. The arrow sticks the other way. Can I just add a few things to that? I think that there's something in the two poles of that, you know, the two poles of that, love and fear. And I think it makes perfect sense in the way the reality works. And I think things, and we could, if you want to talk about that, we could talk a bit about that. But I think things come along that try, a system kind of knows that it's threatened in certain areas. If it's a natural system, it'll have defenses, right? And I think that that things, big things happen, and some of them are left field because it's almost like a system needs to inject something to reset itself in some way that in the future leads it off in a slightly different tangent that means it survives and doesn't destroy itself. So I do think things happen at a system level, and we could talk about what that system is. Some would say a religious thing or whatever, but you know, I think of it as arrangement of information. Everything's information in the end; it really is. You know, you see things happen that reset it. Like for example, I've often thought, and tell me if I'm just going off on tangents you don't want to go, but I often wondered, because it came up through it, the change of music that happened when rock and roll came in, okay? And what happened in the various, and then there was the blues, and then jazz came, and then soul. Oh, I love soul, black soul music. Oh my God, I've got African genetics in me somewhere. And it was all around, it was all very hopeful, and it was a lot of the music examined relationships, some in corny ways, but some in very deep ways. You know, issues of justice and class and all those things, and even, you know, poppy songs address that, and that seemed to be a spike of that. And I've often thought, you know, why did that happen in that way? Obviously there was demand for it. That could be seen as a system reset moment, but we've ended up where we are now, so I don't know if that worked. But you know, any system of reality has to explain why the earth goes around the sun, but also why the Beatles were popular. So I think we need to kind of think very broadly about how things work. But I do think there's always a move, and that's why we conquer everything. But I'm not so sure now, when you start to change the DNA of people, Jerry, that's next level. I don't know what that does to the human condition ultimately, that could dig itself out of a hole if it was in its normal state.
Well, now you're talking some very dark stuff here, because you know, there's a lot of people who would regard what has happened recently as an attack on the very basics of what being human is. And this is why I mean, look, you're a great thinker. You've thought deeply. You think deeply. What if we bring this back a little bit more personal? Bring it right back to you and say, what is it that makes you tick? You know, what makes you tick?
Justice at the moment. I mean, I'm involved in this thing because it aligns with me very well. It does. And that's was not coincidental, but the two things happen independent of itself. So, I saw an interview once, Jerry, with a guy who was the captain of Captain David Cronin, all right? And he was the captain of the United Airlines flight that had the side blow out of it on a flight from Honolulu to Auckland. It was the second to last flight of his 50-year airliner career. Okay. Started off as a sort of a luggage boy, became a pilot, and ended up one of their senior captains right through the 747 years. The side of that aircraft blew out because the cargo door malfunctioned and opened itself in flight with an electrical fault. Seven people went out the side. Three went through the inboard right-hand engine. Terrible. Absolute terrible disaster. Anyway, so they were faced with a fully loaded plane, full fuel, 20 minutes out of Honolulu, 13,000 feet, not much altitude to glide from. He had to turn it around with a huge, humongous, as he described it, he's dead now, hole in the side, and he landed it. And he said it was the best landing of his life, and that was it. Otherwise, 350 people would have died. The point he made was that everything he'd ever done, he realized now, was for that one moment. Everything was for that one moment on the second to last flight of his career at compulsory retirement, 65, whatever. So that's, I don't want to, I'm no David Cronin, okay, but it seems I've done a lot of boring things, laborious things in my career, like endless editing, endless this, endless that. I used to think, I can't stand this. It's like doing the dishes. And, you know, but I got good at it because, you know, you put time in, you get good at things, proficient. And that was on all levels. That's why I go back to, I was lucky to be hired as a cadet because I got trained to be an audio engineer. I got trained to do programming, announcing, into news reading later on. Did 20 years of news reading. And that was a real experience. You get good at something. And I have a feeling similar that all that went into this one moment. And if it's over tomorrow, I don't care. I don't care. It's been done, right? It's been done.
And I've heard so many people say this, Paul. I mean, that these times we're living through, people have said, I feel like I was made for this struggle, for this battle, for truth, for reality, actually for safety for the future generations. That this is a very complicated war to understand, but I believe it is a war. And one of the features of this war is understanding what makes people tick and understanding why someone can sit on a stage and say, we don't need freedoms. and how someone can be that disconnected and how, you know, 180 of Wanaka's oldest and greatest can sit there nodding their heads. These are all human beings. These are all people with families and children. And you know, these are not monsters. These are human beings.
I'll tell you how it happens, Jerry. I can tell you how it happens. I had a moment once, not too long ago, when I was in Auckland, sitting in a bar, right? And all this was just about to really kick off with lockdowns and everything. And I was having a chat with this fella at the bar who was there every now and then. And he was saying a whole lot of stuff. And there's about three things he said that I remember word for word reading in the news. I thought, I see how it works. Those are not your words. You never thought of those words. I told you those words. Now you think that's a thought that you had. It's not the case. And this is what happens. That's why it's so easy. If the boxes are ticked, you will accept it as the normal reality. And you won't be able to see outside of it. That's how, in a way, the brain works at a lower level. I discovered this once when I was doing some filming in Australia for Ansett Airlines. We had to film their simulator base, flight simulator base. So after we'd done this work, we had a bit of time. So one of the guys, Greg, said, we can fly this thing around. It was an A320 Airbus flight simulator. And even back then, it was pretty amazingly, you know, it was like the real thing, you know. And he says, well, we'll fly around, but I'll take the motion off because it strains the hydraulics, you know, and hours operating means maintenance earlier. So I said, okay, that's right. So we came in to Melbourne, to land at Melbourne. He says, we'll do an emergency stop, you know. Okay, so I'm standing behind him in the seat looking out the windscreen of the aircraft, and there's Melbourne runway coming up, sort of dusk graphics. And we hit the brakes, and the thing stops in no time at all. And what happens to me? I fly forward. We're not even moving. And I'll tell you why, because my brain had assessed that all the inputs it's expecting to check off real had been checked off. And as far as I was concerned, if I wasn't in a particular frame of mind separating out sort of sensory information from what was actually happening, I just accepted it without even realizing that this was a real thing. And I even simulated the physics of it.
Can you believe that Plato got this in the first century, maybe second century AD? And he came up with this image of this idea of Plato's cave. He pretty much said, if you project a picture on a cave wall, people will believe it to be real, and they actually won't want to come out the cave for reality. And this was before TV, before we understood neural networks in the brain, before we understood all the unconscious. This guy had it so long ago, this same idea.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I do is I'm also a Photoshop expert, because I've done a lot of TV advertising. I've had to learn the program like the back of my hand. I like drawing up existing photos, redrawing them digitally, repainting them into, like, I'll find an aircraft, and I'll put the livery that those that airline used to have before they got that aircraft on the aircraft to see what it would look like. And there's some now, and I'm a member of a few groups, aviation groups. I put them up. Most people, they'll say, I didn't realize that they painted those and that. They don't go to the higher level and say, that surely must be altered. It's so easy, man. And during COVID, I actually dollied up a picture of myself being injected, because if anyone was going to have a problem, I just need to put that out on social media. And even if I tell them that I didn't get it, they wouldn't believe me, because the photo would have convinced them. I never had to use it.
Now you're talking about really back to this concept of reality and truth versus deceit or manipulation of imagery and lies. And you're talking really about the very essence of what you're doing right now. So when you said what makes you tick is justice.
Justice is that's the reflex action. I don't know why it's me. I pick up on any angle of injustice. I don't know why. And it cuts me to the core. It doesn't matter how serious or minor it is. If it looks like injustice, so there's something in me fires up. It really does. And I don't know why, because I haven't really been treated with any injustice in my life as such, but it's just like a visceral reaction. And that's why I could immediately tell things were not right, because it violated the justice sense in me. You know, it didn't pass the test. And I know I'm right. I was right, of course, you know. And it's usually those reactions you have without even thinking about it that they're wired in differently for some reason. I don't know why.
It's,
you know,
it's like your connection with some kind of instinct, really. Some kind of,
yeah, I feel
that there is an instinctive something inside you, not something you have to go and look up the stats or the data for, but something deeply inside you.
Yeah, I think it's like a physical kind of reaction.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've thought that and realized I was wrong.
If you want to get lies past human beings, the first thing you got to do is get them to be disconnected from their bodies and their feelings, right?
Of course, I'd say you're right. Yeah. Yep. That's and that tough. Voice, there is a voice. There is a voice in there. I've heard it a few times, once audible, and a totally banal situation. What should I do about this? You know what to do.
Just for the listeners, we got a real cameo going on with Paul putting his hand next to his ears, giving himself.
There is a voice, and you know it's working, I think, because it gets to you. First of all, very quickly. There's no sort of slow data track. It's straight in. The other thing is, you tend to be interested to hear what other people think about this. You tend to understand a thing in its sort of global context very quickly. like you sort of see everything all at once, and you think, yeah, okay, I know what that is. Yeah, I can see how that bit works. Boom, boom, boom. But this is all lightning speed. That's how you know it's your voice. Everything else is intellectual. It's a lot slower.
I'm thinking a lot about what you just said. I think it's so important what you're talking about. But listen, if I were to say to you, Paul Brennan, and that's what you're listening to, by the way, I should have probably mentioned that a few times in this interview, but you're listening to real people in the psychotherapist chair with me, Jerry Pives, and I'm talking to Paul Brennan. And Paul, the listeners who are just hear it coming in now, you've missed the interview. This is the end of our interview.
Oh.
If I were to, yeah, we've run out of time, man. And it's been great, because if I were to say to you, or any listener who has heard this, what do you think makes Paul Brennan tick? I would come at you and I would say, you know what? You've said it. You've told us. Justice, truth, and reality, surely.
Yeah, and love is the state, and the consciousness system is the system, and the anti-state to love is fear.
And something about respecting the past and what people have done to give our lives the quality that it has now.
Because remember, they had all the worries and, you know, self-conscious moments and doubts and everything that we have. They were there too, you know. But they overcame them. They made it better. And that's what we have to do. I mean, that's what's passed on. I don't see it happening at the moment. I see a nosedive. And I think the consequences, and I don't want to sound too over the top here, but the consequences could be dire. They could be. You know, like we don't know. I mean, if you follow the line, if you extrapolate the line, I think as we've seen it going so far, the end point is a disaster. It really is for humanity. Because this is not just happening here. You know.
You're talking like an Old Testament prophet.
Maybe. But
you seriously are. And maybe there are a few of us around who are meant to speak out and to foghorn and shout out, you know, what I shouted out at this meeting, you know, after 40 minutes of utter drivel, I shouted out from the back, that's a lie. After
I heard that. I heard about that. Yeah, good on you. Someone has to do it. That might have impacted more people than you realize, Jerry. Like, what? You know, you never know.
Well, it was kind of interesting, because there were a few of my mates and buddies, and we didn't want to disrupt it. We wanted to listen to it. We wanted to hear it. We wanted to find out what they had to say. We were interested in finding out what they had to say. But when it just got so sickening, and a fellow was there before me, as a lovely fellow called Rob, I think he's been interviewed by Alistair, and he shouted out, what about all-cause mortality? Funnily enough, I thought you had snuck in, and I thought, because there was some rumor that you
didn't think it was me.
He sounded like you, and I thought, man, Paul Brennan's there.
You know, he was channeling me.
But he was obviously channeling you. You're not going to shut
well, you up. You see, I know a few of those people. I know Susie. I used to work with Susie a lot. I know Catherine Ryan. I used to work day on day with Catherine. I used to line produce a show for about a year. So I know these people. And I don't think they're bad people. No. But I think that, and this is one of, and I know we've got to wind up, but this is one of the things that really intrigues me. It's the smart people who don't get it the most. We started, first song we played on Reality Check Radio was Common People, the Pulp song by Joe Jackson and William Shatner. I'm for the common people. And I don't mean economically. I think in the way we think, you know?
Well, one of the first people I heard who hit this same point that you're hitting on, which is there's something insidious in our education system or the clever clogs, the bright ones, that they miss what is known to everyday people, is Rainer Fulmich. You know, Rainer Fulmich was the guy who He's been doing, I mean, he probably has done more for getting truth out there than any other individual. And he's now languishing, you know, at the moment, he's languishing in prison. And I just want to shout out to Rainer Fuhrmann, and I hope one day he listens to us. But, you know, we must never forget what Rainer's doing. He's sitting in a prison for speaking out. I think they clapped up some charge of something to do with money that is all untrue. And he said, I'll never forget this, dear old Rainer Fuhrmann, he said, you know what? The funny thing was, when he talked to all the academics about what was going on, he said they were blind. It's like they had blindfolds on. He says, but when he went anywhere in a taxi, then he was talking to real common sense. He was talking to ordinary common people. And he said, they knew that they were being played.
Yeah, I go along with that. I go along with that. And that really fascinates me, how that, I think, probably the selling of tertiary education over the decades has had a component which encourages a certain arrogance if you have a qualification as a status point in your life. I mean, back in the days, when I'm talking about these guys who used to fly these planes and introduce these jet aircraft in New Zealand, did amazing things. They weren't paid more than the freezing worker, mate. They were on the same money. The only thing that differentiated them from the freezing worker and a higher status in the society was what they did. That was the defining thing, not the money. Now it's a lot, the money. But back then, I think there's still some of that. So you can status define yourself in a way there, which actually blinds you with arrogance, literally blinds, and you just don't see it coming. And how could other people like me be so wrong? It's not possible. So I think you get a bit of that. But I don't know where the nastiness comes from. That still has me thinking. I don't know why there's a level of nastiness with that. I'm still thinking about why that is. Like I say, no one's got any reason to feel hard done by in New Zealand. All right? We've had a pretty damn good ride since about 1945, actually. You know, you're lucky to be here. So lucky. So what's the problem? I don't know about that one. Still, maybe you thought about that and come to some sort of conclusion on that. But where the nastiness comes from, I wish I knew.
Well, maybe what's the problem is that voice, you know, and it comes back to love. Sometimes with children, you have to say no. You have to say that's not okay. You have to say you need to respect that person and not make fun of them or behave naughtily around them. This is someone worthy of respect. This is not someone to just ignore. You know, there's something about parenting and about what they call tough love. The real parenting is when you say something to your child that they makes them dislike you, but you know it's an important thing for them to get to function well in their adult life. And I think what we've got is a problem of parenting, perhaps.
Yeah, I think you're onto something. Yep. Yep.
Which is that it's just, let's do the easy thing. Life is easy. They can mess around. They can break this. They can be rude. They can do that. And now we're seeing this lived out as adults who actually never did understand what operating in the world of adults means, what being grown up. I mean, I've got two phrases, you know, which is number one, grow up and face the music. And there's some pretty rough music going on right now. So it's tough. And the other one is just grow a pair, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. True. Anyone who can grow a pair. Yeah. if we're going to finish on something, I'd just like to finish on this. I thought of it earlier, but then it went out of my mind. And you mentioned something that, and I started talking about Bob in Seattle. And the reason I talked about Bob was he did a speech that I saw at the Museum of Flight when they got number one 727 in from Payne Field, where the 747s were assembled, which is about 20 miles north of Boeing Field, which is more in Seattle area, city area, and flew it in there. And that took 20 years to do. But anyway, he did the speech and his question was, do aircraft have a soul? Which is, on the surface, you'd say, of course not. They're made of metal. They're inanimate objects. And what do they know? And they're machines and that's it. But he said he thought they did. And it wasn't the actual physical properties. It was the person who thought of it, the person who designed it, the person who manufactured it, the person who flew it, everyone that kept it operational, and everyone who flew in it. Now, that 727 was a 126-seat plane, and in its time with United Airlines, 3.6 million people had flown in it. Think about that. 3.6 million in this little tube. Now, our DC-8, I worked it out. 1.8 million New Zealanders flew in that aircraft in the 18 years they had it. And that 737, about 2.5 million people flew up and down the country on that machine before it was done. They were there for all sorts of reasons, Jerry. Good, bad, sad, happy, going to weddings, coming back from funerals, business deal that went well or didn't go well. Everything's in there. And it is in there. It's part of the physical object. And that's what you get. So I remember Bob saying that, and I remember thinking, yeah, I think you're right, Bob. Yeah. And that just spurred me on to go even harder, because I think of all those people, including the Queen. I'm one of them.
So there's real poetry.
Oh, and can I tell you one other anecdote? Please, I know we're running out of time. But that back to the aircraft, and a lot of things have happened like this. So Don Nickel was a DC-8 captain back in the 70s. And his son, Andrew Nickel, wrote the screenplay to The Truman Show. So when I went to interview him in his rest home at Paraparaumu, he lived there as well, he's dead now, he had a BAFTA award sitting on his shelf. And I thought, okay, you got a BAFTA award. I said, okay, do you mind me asking you how you got the BAFTA award? He explained about his son. Anyway, there was an incident in Wellington in 1976 where he was flying the DC-8 in at night, and it was a southerly sort of bluster, and visibility was low. And there was a navigation aid that was broken that no one had alerted them to. So they calculated themselves about 2 miles from the position that they thought they were 2 miles further south over the harbour than where they were actually. And that was above, if people know Wellington, the hills of Newlands. So when planes are flying into the south, they come right over that suburb, quite low, about 1,000, 1,500 feet. But he went over at 200 feet in this huge airliner at night in the rain, with screaming power on because all the high lift devices are out and it's a lot of drag, so high power, huge noise, and it freaked out the locals big time, and it was dangerously low. Turned out that there was a problem with the nav aid. He was alerted to this after he landed and got the engineering to do an inspection of the nav aids on the plane to make sure they were working properly, and they were. And then he flew off on a charter later that night to Nandi to pick up a sports team. So this is a big, almost 200-seater airliner. Anyway, so what happened was it made the newspaper, and there was a headline. I remember the headline of the Evening Post, and I've got a microfilm shot of it. "I thought he was going to fly through the ranch slider window," was the headline. Some, you know, freaked out local. And that was bad publicity for Air New Zealand. So they hung Don out to dry, right? And he was permanently demoted to co-pilot, and he thought, sod this. I've done my time. And he was, a Second World War guy. So he resigned and set up an engineering business and did incredibly well with that. But that was always stuck. Always stuck with him. Anyway, about 10 years ago, Rob Fyfe, who was the head of Air New Zealand then, had a meeting with families and related people to the Erebus disaster. And it was an apology from the company, finally, on how they were treated. Don described this to me. Anyway, he was invited, and he was wondering why he was invited, because he wasn't even there. You know, he'd a year or two before that, Erebus in 79 had resigned and left, changed his career. Anyway, Rob Fyfe, he told me, Rob Fyfe approached him, said, "Hey, Don, know who you are. And, I guess you're wondering why you're here." He says, "I've done a deep dive into all of this, and I know what happened in 76 with that nav aid. No one told anyone." He says, "You know what, Don? If we'd sorted that out right there and then, Erebus would not have happened." Now, that aircraft sitting in derelict in Manaus, Brazil, is that aircraft. That's the actual plane. See how it connects? Because they would have sorted out their staff, the way they functioned, you know? that people would have been alerted to things. Like they would have been alerted to the change of waypoint on the Erebus flight plan. They weren't. They thought they were somewhere else. Same thing happened. And if they cleaned that up, they would have had procedures in place. That would have been caught. It would never have happened.
Anyway. Fast forward to health professionals covering up the truth about their treatments.
Yep. You see the pattern? See what happens? Bad things happen.
Bad things happen.
You get that Swiss cheese moment, the holes line up, and it's bad.
Yeah. Well, on that cheerful note.
Well, it was cheerful because he felt okay now after all those years. You know?
Did they apologize to him?
Officially.
Public apology? Yeah. Fantastic.
Well, as public as it can be for the level of interest it had, but certainly inside the community it was a big deal, and he'd carried that since 1976, and he knew that that came out of that, because he's not dumb, wasn't dumb. So anyway, that's one of the things I remember, and that goes to what we're talking about, the truth. You need to know what's true. And I don't know about you, Jerry, but the more the deception, the badder it is. That's how I measure it now. It's almost like an algorithm. The more deception, the more baked in deception, the worse it is.
Well, I could talk with you for another three interviews and still not get bored or get to the end of our conversation, but we have to stop now.
Yep.
I'm gonna have you back for, I have to say, a session that both excites me and frightens the tits off me, because I'm going to be interviewing, I'm going to be asking you about seven tracks of music to define your life.
Right, yes. That's even more difficult than anything else to do.
But for now, Paul Brennan, thank you so much for sitting with me and the listeners in the psychotherapist chair, hearing about your life, hearing about what makes you tick, hearing about the importance of justice, hearing about your life and how you were drawn to the voice, conversations about the voice inside.
We can do so much with the voice, Jerry. That's one thing I've learned, is you can take, and not that I'd want to do, I'd try to do this, but depending on how you use that voice, it can be a one hell of a roller coaster ride. It can be the ultimate high, or it could be, you know, pretty serious. And that's a powerful thing. If you know how to modulate it, no one's a master, but if you kind of know how to use it, you can change things. And look what we did at election time. I know I keep crowing about that. You know, and that's all of us using our voice in certain ways, you know, and to be persuasive, and that's okay. You're allowed to be persuasive. You have to sound persuasive. You really do, I think. And I see a lot of our politicians don't have this skill at all. They can't lift the people up. They can't sit there like some revival. Come on, we're going up. We're not going down. We're going up. Who's on board? Here's how we're going to do it. Come on. You. I don't hear that ever.
One of the most powerful uses of the human voice, sometimes I find, is to say absolutely nothing.
And there's that. like not getting up in a crowded hall and saying, what about the, yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for sharing your time generously. I know you're a busy fella, and thank you for sharing and letting us have a little peep into your life, your history, a bit about your family. And I'm struck by the history, man. I'm struck by your love of history and how, you know, really to close this, I just want to say, I think I agree with you. Airplanes do have a soul. So what reflections do I have? Well, what really gripped me about that session was the way in which Paul talked about the polar opposites of fear and love. And I'm going to talk about fear and love and the role of fear in the psychological war that I believe we're undergoing right now. And I'm going to make some suggestions as to how to operate away from fear and towards love. So you're listening to Real People on RCR. My name's Jerry Pives. And this is the second part of three parts of my weekly show. And in this part, I'm going to be reflecting on some psychological ideas and some psychological tips and tricks to help you get through your week. Please do write in to inbox@realitycheck.radio or text at 2057. Tell me how you're getting on. Tell me about your thoughts in relation to what I'm talking about, and tell me how you're getting on with this show. I'd love to hear from you, and I'd love to answer your questions. So Paul talked about entropy, third thermodynamic law of something or other. And he talked that entropy was really how things degenerate. The word entropy actually means to turn and to turn inwards, which is really interesting. The origin of the word means to, as it were, go in on oneself and to descend into a kind of chaos. And things tend towards entropy unless we do something about it. And Paul used the wonderful example of the steam engine, didn't he? And saying how originally the steam engines went pretty fast, but now they have to work really, really hard at renewal and renewing them in order to make them work. And he said that the opposite of entropy is love, which is, as it were, the other end of that, that somehow love takes us beyond entropy. And of course, love is actually an outward thing. It takes us to others. And it's instead of the despair and the chaos of entropy, we have the hope and the joy of love. And if we link this, these two movements within each of us, it's easy to go inward and to go into a kind of internal chaos. And sometimes it's very challenging to reach out and to, as it were, act in love or to engage in love in action, because I do believe that love is something that we do. If we link this duality between entropy, despair, and fear, and love, expansion, creation, and hope, then what I really want to do is to link this with Paul's remarkable story of being in a flight simulator. And I wonder if you remember how he talked about being in a flight simulator that they had switched off all the movement to. All he was left with were the visual clues. And when the plane landed and braked hard, Paul described how, despite the fact that there was nothing other than visual cues, he found himself propelled forward, proving, I think, something we've known a lot in psychology for a long time about, which is that our brains believe what we see. In fact, our brains operate on pictures and stories, and very often those stories are told in pictures. So if the pictures we hold in our mind can literally propel us forward when nothing's happening, other than the story that our brain is being told, then the most important thing for every human being who wants to be free is to know, so who's controlling the pictures? Who's controlling the narrative? I wonder who's controlling your pictures. So you see, who controls your pictures controls your mind and controls your actions. And it's worth reflecting on The Art of War by Sun Tzu and how he said that all warfare is based on deception. And that is 1,000% more true. when we are dealing with a psychological war. And I believe that we are in the middle of a psychological war. We're actually in a war, I believe, for the very heart and soul of humanity. They're trying to change the DNA of humanity. That's horrifying. That's a war. And I wonder if you remember when Paul talked about meeting a guy in a bar, and he didn't elaborate, but what he said was, this guy had three reasons to argue against whatever was going on. And Paul immediately knew that those three ideas had literally been inserted into his brain by pictures and images. He knew that these were not the person's own words. They had been, as it were, manipulated into him. And you see, if we're in a war, then deception is the key to the victory of the people trying to manipulate populations. And let's face it, if you're a tiny, small number of very wealthy people and you want to control millions or billions of people, you've got to do a war of the mind. You've got to control their minds. That's the smartest way to do it. And right from the 1930s, the use of marketing and advertising has utilized psychological techniques. Freud's own nephew was a major influencer in the control of the population and the mind. And there's a whole subject there I'm not going to go into. But the key feature that is used when you're trying to control a population through their minds is fear. Well, have we seen a little bit of fear going around the place recently? So I don't really believe it that much. In fact, one definition of fear is to take the four letters, F-E-A-R, and turn it into false evidence appearing real. False evidence appearing real. And what happens when we are frightened or terrified with the idea that we're about to drop dead? What happens is that that fear hits the limbic brain, the middle part of our brain, our emotional brain, it's called. And that part of the brain controls our whole body. So from the fear that is fed to us, the stimulus in the middle brain, our whole body reacts, and it dictates how we act, how we behave. And from fear, as Paul correctly pointed out, and he is quite the philosopher, entropy and fear lead to despair. And if you want to win a war, the worst soldiers are those that are in despair. They're incapacitated by despair and fear. Which means we've got a kind of a flow chart here. We've got false evidence appearing real, hitting our limbic brain, transmitting to our whole body, dictating how we act. Well, how about we reverse that? How do we deal with this? Is by reversing it. So we go backwards from action and we choose our own actions. We take charge. And we choose actions that speak of love. So we go out into nature where we love the profound beauty of our created planet. We choose the action of love that takes us into community, especially when we're involved in helping each other. The love of care that humans have for each other. We hate to see suffering. Everyone hates it, no matter what we've been told. We choose the action of giving rather than demanding as if we're entitled. We choose the actions, the human actions of music and arts, of dance, of singing, of the crafts, of growing vegetables, of caring for the land. And we choose the action of purposeful behavior. What we do must be directed towards something that has goodness in it. I don't care what your job is, but what is the purpose of your job? To bring your children up so they have a good future, to build a house, to make the world a better place in some way. So these are the actions. And if we behave in a certain way, then we're transmitting a choice of love, into our body through the action. And that body movement, that action, transmits back to our limbic brain. So we're reversing the flow. We're literally taking charge of the body, taking charge of our action, and we're reclaiming the limbic brain with, guess what? All the good feelings that come from the love of what we're doing. And that brings joy. And above all, in the limbic brain, it brings pleasure. And with pleasure and the actions of love, we create hope. And you see, hope is the end product of us working on love. Love in action, L-I-A, love in action. So I wanted to say that by far the best way to survive these terrible times, and they are terrible because you're being lied to. We're all being lied to. The way to defeat that is to focus on your actions. Ground yourself in what you're doing. Decide it, choose it, because you are the master of your own destiny. The screens would have you do what they want you to do. And obviously, stay away from those as much as you can. And more importantly than anything is, do not believe any of the stories you hear, especially the ones that come on screen. You see, I physically went along to a talk called Truth and Lies. I didn't watch it on a screen. And when I was there in the hall, I watched the four people on stage. And what I saw, I don't know what others saw, but what I saw were four frightened people lacking in any congruity of what they were speaking about. You know, their words and their bodies were contradicting each other. One was talking about something, you know, that was fun and nice and exciting, but sat like a frightened rabbit. So when you get away from the screens, by the way, one of the reasons I love audio, when you get away from the screens, then you can have your own experience and you can trust your own reactions to what is going on. You have an instinctive knowledge. The more you operate from love, the more you recoil from fear and darkness. Grow your decisions on real people that you meet, real nature that you experience, at the arts, that the body has, the body work, the healing of touch. These are how you fight fear, by focusing on the actions of love, which translate to the limbic brain, which brings hope and brings hope back to you through the body. In other words, the way to fight entropy is through love, but it's the actions of love. As Paul said in his interview, you have to work at love. Well, what do you think about that? Let me know. Send me an email, inbox@realitycheck.radio. Send me a message by text, 2057. I'd love to read what you have to say.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.